You're listening to Monday Morning Live, part of the We Love Where You Live podcast series brought to you by the Michigan Municipal League.
Good morning. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Monday Morning Live. I'm Tony Mangini, sitting in for Matt Bach. Matt will be back for our next broadcast, which will not be Monday, by the way, because that'll be Labor Day. So that'll be on the Tuesday following Labor Day. Be sure to join us for that. Happy to be joined this morning by Chris Johnson, our general counsel here at the league. Good morning.
Morning.
We're going to be talking about, we got two topics we're going to cover today. The first one is going to be an update on the Headley lawsuit, which we have had podcasts about and several articles about. We have a ruling in that case from the Supreme Court. From the appellate court.
Yes, court.
I'm sure we'll talk about the Supreme Court at some point. And then we're going to, at the end of it, we'll be talking a little bit about a case out of Troy and that involves the setting of our building department fees and things like that. So very exciting stuff. So let's kick it off with the Headley lawsuit. Like I said, we had a decision come down. It was sort of a mixed bag on various counts. So why don't you give us a little background on where we are right now?
Well, this was a case that was filed by concerned taxpayers, and it really amounted to the balance between the constitutional requirement for spending money on the local side as well as the state side. Not only did Headley put in a restriction on local funding, but it also decided in that amendment that they had to fund those activities at least to the same level that they had before.
They being the state.
And the state never has complied with that. They claim they have, but they've been moving a lot of parts and a lot of the revenues around. So the basis of the constitutional claims that were made were four different arguments. First was that there was a change in the way that education is funded in the state of Michigan, and that was Proposal A. Mm-hmm. Proposal A changed the way local governments, especially school districts, were funded. Originally, local units of government, school districts, would tax themselves and pay for their own schools. And this was eliminated through Proposal A, and they decided to do a statewide sales tax. And the statewide sales tax then funded this governmental entity.
And that's when we went from 4 cents to 6 cents. So that 2 cents is the tax dedicated to the school funding that you're talking about.
That's correct. So we now have a shift in terms of how we pay for it. And the state essentially took all that revenue and said, this is a local commitment, even though in the past it had been funded locally rather than on a state basis.
So going back to what you said a minute ago, the Headley Amendment, this is one of those provisions people forget about. One of the key things was, hey, state, you got to spend the same amount proportionally of the funding you get right now on local government as you did beforehand, to make sure that they didn't start to put requirements on local government and not fund them. And so when Prop A passed and it created all this funding shifts, our argument or the lawsuit's argument has been that the state didn't do that correctly, and that in fact did change that proportion.
Right, and that's a major component of what local government is credited with at this point by the state of Michigan. That would amount to a huge amount of shifting of the tax base. The other interesting thing was state mandates. It's right in the Headley Amendment. If there's a new state mandate, the state pays for it, not the local unit of government. And that's been clear from the beginning. But what they've done is, while the state will fund the new mandate, they credit it back to the local share. So if you look at it carefully, it's pretty true that they're not funding the local, the new mandate. They're just taking it out of the other pocket on the local government side. And then the third argument that was being made was, do charter schools and all the funding that's going into charter schools count in the local share or not? It's clear that there's no governmental entity that's overseeing and operating these kinds of charter schools. They can be for profit. They can be religious based. They can be commercially based. Mm-hmm. So there's no real government oversight over a charter school. And the state puts all the money that they give to charter schools in the local government pile. So those were the three basic arguments. And then the fourth count was a claim for damages going back as far as the statute of limitations would allow. As a strategic matter, the plaintiffs in the case, the day before the Court of Appeals argument, waived the damage claim going in the past. Basically, they didn't want to bankrupt the state.
And it's contrary to what people might think. While the courts are generally ruling on the law, they're not going to be oblivious to the impacts of that decision. And so that was where the strategy of that change came in.
Right. So they dropped the damages claim for past damages and really were looking prospectively to change. As a result of the Court of Appeals decision, they did not agree with the plaintiff's position on Proposal A. They said local money is local money. And it's kind of interesting to see the way the opinion is written. Mm-hmm. It's kind of political as much as it is legally granted. And as you mentioned before, courts are really concerned with the overall impact of a decision and how that would change the current funding system. So they denied the argument there. They granted the argument on the state mandates. So the plaintiffs won on that particular count. And there was a similar decision in terms of denying the plaintiff's argument on the charter school situation. So basically, the local units of government won one out of the three arguments that were argued in front of the Court of Appeals. And now is going to be a decision time for the plaintiffs as to whether or not to appeal the two. And the state has to decide whether it's going to appeal the decision related to the state mandates.
Now the charter school argument, there was a dissent on the charter school argument, if I remember correctly. Is that correct?
Yes, there is.
We had a unanimous defeat, a unanimous victory, and then we had a split decision on one of those. So for the kids keeping score at home. But I thought the dissent was interesting because the dissent really did sort of follow, I think, the arguments that were being made as to why, in fact, because the argument, as you pointed out, around the charter schools had to do with the idea not – we're not questioning whether or not there can be charter schools or whether that's an appropriate way to educate people. What we're arguing is they're not local governments. And so to take credit for spending money, giving them money, funding, however you want to think about that, and crediting that towards this Headley requirement to fund local government, that's the crux of our argument, correct? I keep saying our argument, even though we're not plaintiffs on this. We have a vested interest for sure.
That is the argument. If local governments are not overseeing what's happening in those schools and not actually regulating what's going on, I think it's really hard for the state to say, yeah, this is local government, because it doesn't walk like a duck, it doesn't talk like a duck, or quack like a duck. So you really have a situation where I think the dissent was right on, and we'll get a chance to see with the Michigan Supreme Court whether they agree on that topic. As you evaluate the impact of all these three issues, clearly, the Proposal A argument has the most significant impact financially, both on the state and local government, because tremendous amount of dollars will be moved from the state side to the local side. And probably right after that, there's millions and millions of dollars that are spent on the charter funding. So those two are probably the most financially, or biggest impact financially. Mm-hmm. And I think we'll see probably an appeal on both of those because the bulk of the money is right there.
So at the end of the day, both sides are likely to appeal because if one side appeals and you don't, now you've sort of given up your opportunity to go back up to the plate, right?
Right.
So probably do that. In terms of the mandates too, as I recall, there was another thing, and there was a fancy legal term that I didn't know what it was, but they called the state out for basically saying, since the Headley Amendment passed, the state has never fulfilled their constitutional responsibilities to report annually the cost of these mandates and the funding that's being used for those. Can you talk about that for a second?
Sure. There's implementation language that pretty much requires the state to do an annual calculation on the whole ratio of the money that's spent on the state side and the money that's spent on the local side. Add them up and come to a conclusion as to whether or not they're actually following that part of the Headley Amendment. They haven't done that calculation ever. So actually the Court of Appeals issued a writ of mandamus, which is, in legal terms, that's a pretty extraordinary thing. That's basically the court telling another branch of government, the executive branch, do your job. And it sounds simple, but it doesn't happen very often where the courts really take a look at what the executive branch is doing and say, you just haven't been doing it. So in this case, they're asking the state to go back to 1979 and make all the calculations. And that's why we don't know yet what kind of impact that those mandate issues are going to have. It's possible that it may not be significant enough to put more money on the local side. However, it depends on whether they throw in things to the calculation like the new lead and copper rules. Mm-hmm.
Veterans exemptions.
Mm-hmm. That's, no one is disagreeing with the need for a veterans exception. The state thinks it's wonderful, and then the local unit of government pays for it. And they pay for it by not getting the revenue. Mm-hmm. And the state's not reimbursing the local unit. So it is a mandate. It is a new mandate, and if it doesn't get funded, who picks up the tab? The local taxpayer. And I'm not saying that the state knows but more or less than the local unit of government does here.
I'll say that in a minute, but go ahead.
What my point is that, you know, if you come up with a great idea, you should be funding it. Mm-hmm. Just like in some communities, you know, they have more emphasis on parks, or they may emphasize reading programs, or they may emphasize something totally different than the local unit next door. But that's a local choice. Now we have a situation where the state is making those choices for us.
Well, and again, going back to where we started, Headley anticipated that, right? So when they prepared that constitutional amendment, that was the whole purpose behind this split and the requirement that we not diminish that. Because they do recognize the state, you know, which way the poo-poo flows. We'll talk about sewer stuff later. And to say that they have the ability to impose things on us, they recognize that in the crafting of that constitutional amendment. But then they also said, thou shalt pay for those. And that's where we have really had the disconnect on this stuff. And that's why it's so important that this lawsuit, you know, is being pursued in the way it is. And it's very interesting, I think, the way this has been framed up and presented these issues, because they are very complicated on some levels. On the other, they're very simple. It's pretty straightforward in terms of the questions that they're asking and that they're asking the court to consider. And the impacts, though, are huge. They're absolutely huge for local government. It's an extension of what we've been talking about for years, whether it's our revenue sharing or other tax reform things that we talk about. It all ties back into all those things.
Well, and the real problem, if you think about it for a moment, Headley's now about 40 years old. And these things happen gradually over time. But if you really add them all up over all the years that Headley's been in existence, you can see the tremendous impact that it's had. And just the mandate issue alone, you're taking money out of one pocket to put it in another pocket. You know, local governments are limited by the Headley Amendment as to how they can collect higher revenues. And we're not saying, if you just look at inflation, that's going to require a higher level of revenue, mm-hmm. as we all know. So basically, Headley is saying you can't have more revenue unless you go to the voters every time. So that means if you want a cost of living increase every year, you have to go to the voters, basically. So it's really difficult in that situation. And 40 years of constantly putting a couple of drops in and a couple of, you know, little squirts and finally, you know, the whole bucket, you're looking at a tremendous amount of money.
Yeah, that's how the Grand Canyon started, a drop at a time, right?
That's true.
You know, and when you talk about the ability to raise revenues or do certain things as well, it's not just as simple as asking your voters, right? Because you have to have statutory authority in order to even ask that question. So that's either got to be in your existing taxing capacity or some other statutory authority, unlike the state, who does have the ability to make adjustments in taxes and do other things. Another safeguard, again, that was put in Headley, they have powers that we don't. And so it's incumbent upon them to make these decisions instead of pushing those down. So this is a really, really, really important case. If you had to handicap, you know, thinking about this going forward, how do you feel about the arguments and the way this is framed up and the likelihood of the Supreme Court hearing this stuff?
Well, the Supreme Court's going to look at the actual constitutional language, and I think that the constitutional language is pretty clear. There's a clear requirement in the Constitution now that the states spend in the same proportion that they did in 1978 when the voters adopted that. And I think once you start doing the calculations that the state's never done conveniently, I think there's a good chance that that will prevail. So then when you put various buckets or money in the various buckets, then local side or state side, I think we have a very good argument on Proposal A because those funds were always generated at a local level before. It was funded by locals, and now it's not. But the replacement revenue should go in that same pot.
Mm-hmm. You can't change half the fraction, basically.
Yeah, and they have. And then the argument that the charter school is a local unit of government is clearly wrong. The state just made a ruling fairly recently from the Michigan Supreme Court that said tribal government is not local government. It is a tribal government and doesn't do the exact same things that local government does. In fact, they're recognized under our treaties as being their own sovereign nations. So that's a whole different set of circumstances now that I don't think the Court of Appeals really looked at when they made this decision.
And didn't that decision come out almost overlapping on top of the decision on this Headley lawsuit?
Right. It came out just, you know, weeks before the Court of Appeals finally ruled on this case.
And so, because I think what the state's kind of argued as well, education is education. Doesn't matter if Chris is doing it as an individual or as a government. You're providing it, therefore, it's the same. And when you talked about the tribal thing, they said, no, they may do all the same things. That doesn't make them a government, right? There's the elected official things and all these other safeguards that need to be in place, really, to be a local government. And charter schools clearly don't check any of those boxes.
They don't check very many of them at all, let alone all of them.
Yeah.
And just the oversight that, you know, Joe Citizen has to stand up in an audience and say, hey, what about the budget? Why are you putting all the money in this category instead of that category? It doesn't exist in a charter, especially in a for-profit situation where the bottom line is much more important than whether the kids actually get an education. So that's an important difference.
It's a huge difference, right? I mean, it's difference between private education and public education. And is that accountability? And again, the ability for all of us to participate in that democracy. You know, I mean, we think sometimes we take that for granted here in this country, but it's real. And it's something that really is at the heart of what we do here. And so I think that'll be really interesting to see how the Supreme Court views on that. I know we were talking about it this offline, you know, some of us kind of felt like maybe on some of these things, the appeals court maybe thought it was above their pay grade. Like, let the Supreme Court make the call on this one. We're not going to change it.
Well, as I mentioned before, I think the opinion is a little suspect in that it comes to a conclusion that doesn't necessarily bankrupt the state real quickly, but that isn't necessarily the correct legal standard. And I have more faith that the Supreme Court will look at the constitutional questions as opposed to the political questions.
Yeah, that's good stuff. So let's shift gears if we can for a minute. This one might be even drier than the Headley stuff, but there was a decision recently relating to a case between the city of Troy and there's a builders group suing them over the setting of building department fees and how that was done and whether that met the statutory requirements or whatnot. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. That was Michigan Home Builders versus the City of Troy. And it's a case that's gone on since 2010. So we have a long 9-year history with this. It also involved a specific contract that the City of Troy has with a major player in the business, which is Safebuilt. So some people call it the Safebuilt case. Some people call it Michigan Builders Association. But in any event, what the crux of the lawsuit was that more money was going from the building department and the fees that were collected by the building department to the general fund. And this, the plaintiffs alleged, the Builders Association alleged that they were actually funding governmental operations out of the building department. There is a statute in Michigan that is very clear that you can contract these operations out to private firms, but it also requires that the revenue specifically be related to the service that's being provided in the building inspection department. And then, no, it has to be related exactly to that. It cannot fund other parts of the government. Mm-hmm. So, for example, you can't do a for-profit building department and run all your other operations of government out of the building department. And that was a clear mandate in the statute. The Supreme Court remanded the case back to the trial court to take a look at all those issues. First of all, they again, emphasized all three points in the statute that said, do not do this, do not do that, do not do do all the things that the statute prohibits. And they also were very bothered by the fact that Troy didn't supply the actual documents that proved that all of the costs that were related to the building department were funded through that and only that.
Yeah. Now, there was another nuance to this that I think is sort of specific to this situation, and that was there was a limiter in the fees. And it basically said, we're going to charge, $10. Contractor, you're going to get $8. We're going to get $2. So it was an 80-20 split. And part of the argument was is that split didn't necessarily correlate to the cost. And that was when you say they didn't make the case as to that, that was one of the things the court sort of looked at and said, how'd you get to that split? And that also, I think, was part of what they were sort of evaluating.
Well, here's the irony that the trial court may ultimately find. Once Troy starts to break down the actual costs of what's going on, how much time the clerk's office is spending processing the paperwork, how much time and effort goes into various other departments supporting the building department, there actually may be more money that's going to have to be charged to cover what the building costs are. But they hadn't, at least at this point in the litigation, actually convinced the Supreme Court that all of those items and all those boxes were checked. Mm-hmm. So I think we'll be in a situation where the trial court's going to really get it into detail, and many of the arguments that were made in the lower court that finally got up to the trial court just hadn't separated out the revenue and then assigned specific tax or tasks to the revenue. Mm-hmm.
So this is still an ongoing case. This is something that it got kicked back to the lower court again to continue to complete the record, it sounds like. Is that fair to say?
That's fair to say.
Okay. And then it's interesting because I just sort of know from, previous life, when that statute passed, I think there was a belief in the building community that communities were getting rich off what they were charged, especially if you're in a community, and I happen to be in one that was doing a lot of building. There was this belief that we were making all this extra money on there. And our analysis consistently showed, as I suspect Troy's will eventually show, that we weren't even covering the cost of doing some of these things. Just because in aggregate they might have been millions of dollars because of the volume of building, it really wasn't getting into that spot. And so, but there is a burden to make sure that, again, you can justify that. There's a lot of references in that statute to reasonableness and actually two different references, I think, to reasonableness, right? Must be reasonable and must reasonably have a relationship to the cost of the service or something like that. So they're really driving home this idea of being reasonable. But it is something, and a lot of our members probably look at this and go, what are you even arguing about? We had, you know, $8,000 in building fees last year. But in some of the bigger communities that have lots of development, it's a significant amount of money coming in and out of the department.
And Troy would be one of those Absolutely. Communities because there's been a lot of building since 2010. But the trial court will now require the city to actually lay out, you know, this person spends this amount of time, that person spends that amount of time, and aggregate it all up to see whether the whole amount is justified or not. And they were working on percentage basis, which bothered the Michigan Supreme Court, and they didn't see the direct correlation.
Got it. Well, it sounds like we have two different topics, of which we'll definitely be coming back and talking about these again. They're both sort of a work in progress. When does a decision have to be made on the Headley appeal? Whether or not to appeal, that's what I mean to say.
Mid-September. I'm thinking approximately the 19th.
Okay, so that'll be coming quick. So, again, some future weeks and months ahead, we'll be coming back to talk about that. Mm-hmm. We'll also be talking about this building fee case, because again, that's something that applies to everybody. It's a really important thing to do. So I want to thank everybody for joining us. Again, our next Monday Morning Live will be on Tuesday, September 3rd, as opposed to Monday. And Matt Bach will be back here hosting at that time. He'll be back joining us for that. So thank you very much for joining us today. Hope this was of value, and look forward to seeing you again.
This has been a production of the Michigan Municipal League. For more information on our programs and services, please visit www.mml.org and join us for the next episode of We Love Where You Live.